Just about every day, we're told that some food is going to kill us. Whether it's carbs or fats or proteins or what have you, we're told each week that a different thing is going to kill us. In this episode of Open for Discussion, we're going to talk with Associate Professor Amanda Salas, who's a senior researcher at the University of Sydney's Bowden Institute of Obesity, Nutrition, Exercise, and Eating Disorders, based at the Charles Perkins Center. Today, she leads a research team that's unraveling the science of how our brain affects hunger, emotions, and body weight.
Amanda, welcome to Open for Discussion.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your research and what brought you to it?
So my research aims to find better ways for people to lose weight and keep it off throughout life. So what brought me to this area of research is personal dilemma, basically. I was obese, severely obese, in fact, as a teenager and young adult. And I was always struggling to lose weight. I mean, I could lose weight, but I could never lose more than a few kilos, and then it would just come back on, plus more. So I knew there was something wrong with this whole idea of, you know, just eat less, move more, and keep going until you get there. So that's why I decided to start medical research to find better ways to help people to lose weight and keep it off.
That's brilliant. And looking at you, I would have never thought that you were severely obese as a child.
Well, not as a child. I was a fat kid, but severely obese as a young adult. But now I've lost 30 kilos and have kept it off for a lot of years, more than 18 years, in fact.
That's brilliant. And you're looking at different diets and the way people process food. And so, you know, when we think about all these things and we hear that protein's good, carbs are bad, fat is bad, how do you mediate between all the different kinds of diets that we hear about?
Yeah, so the world is full of conflicting messages about nutrition and what is optimally good for human health and weight management and well-being. So there's a lot of confusing messages out there about human nutrition. And human nutrition is an area of research that's incredibly complex. Like, food is made up of many components, macronutrients, micronutrients. Also, health is a multi-dimensional thing as well. There's so many aspects to health, more than just weight or cardiovascular diseases. It's the whole shebang, mental health, everything together. But there are some messages from nutrition research that are clear as crystal, and these are messages that have made their way into public health recommendations in countries all around the world. And these messages are reducing the amount of processed foods you eat. This is something that all health agencies agree on. Everyone agrees that having a variety of foods is important. And that's because food contains things that are good for us, the macronutrients and micronutrients, and also contains things that are bad for us, like toxins or anti-nutrients that block the absorption of good nutrients. So by having a variety of foods, you mix it up, you get a bit of everything good and not too much of anything bad.
What about the carbs question? Like, I remember in the 80s when everyone said, stop eating butter and start eating margarine, and so my whole family stopped eating butter and started eating margarine. And then 20 years later, they were like, oh, it really doesn't make a difference. I feel that way a little bit about carbs. Like, I'm a carb-aholic, if that's a thing. Is that, are carbs the devil? Or what should we do about carbs?
Yeah. So, and I can see you've got a nice big box of lollipops on your desk. So I can see you really are a carb man, I think. So the thing about carbs is, well, we need carbohydrates. Obviously, fitting in with those public health guidelines about reducing processed foods, obviously the less processed carbohydrates are better. So the healthy carbs are the ones we want, things like oats and brown rice and wholemeal pasta, etc., things with a lot of fiber and chewy things. These are good. The processed ones, we want less of those. And the carbohydrates are important because they contain a lot of nutrients, fiber, vitamins. They're important for our diet.
So carbs won't kill you?
Carbs will actually make you live longer. They're a beneficial food. Now,
then what are people on about?
Now, the reason why this whole carb phobia has come about is that nutritional research has traditionally been done in a way that looks at one nutrient and one outcome. So this is in the days of scurvy, and it was discovered that, for example, if you don't have vitamin C, you get scurvy. If you put the vitamin C back, you don't get scurvy, or you cure the scurvy. In looking at complex diseases such as diabetes, obesity, cardiovascular disease, it has been traditional to look at, okay, well, let's see what happens to cardiovascular disease risk if you remove carbs and put them back. And it's only taking a single nutrient view on the problem.
So I'm going to continue to eat carbs, basically. So setting aside the moral reasoning around people who eat meat or don't eat meat, is there nutritionally, is there anything that's better or worse that they need to be aware of?
The thing is, so around the world, there are so many different diets, but there is not one single diet that we can say is better than any other diet, as long as those general principles of public health nutrition recommendations are followed, like variety, fruits and vegetables, reducing processed foods. We hear a lot about the Mediterranean diet, and that's a diet which, again, is low in processed foods, high in fruits and vegetables, natural oils. It's got a balance of a variety of different foods, some fish, some legumes, a bit of meat, not too much. So that's been proven to be beneficial for reducing cardiovascular disease risk. But it's not the only diet that is healthful and beneficial. So I was in Norway a couple of weeks ago and meeting the author of the New Nordic Diet. So it's a publication, a lovely clinical trial testing the Norwegian style of food, and it's based on what's available. There's fish, and it's salted, oily fish, not a whole variety of fruits, but they've got some berries, and it's seasonal. And that was shown also to be very beneficial for health as well. So there's no single style of eating that we can say is better than others, as long as it follows those general nutrition public health principles.
I mean, I used to joke for years / last week that most of what I eat comes in a box or through a window. And are those the problem items, I'm guessing?
Well, it depends how the food is processed. It's not processed food per se, which is a problem. Because, I mean, we need food processing. We need it. Because otherwise we can't feed the whole world. We need to be realistic about it. But it's the number of additives. It's the amount of steps that have been taken to get that food from the farm into that box that you're eating from. So it's really thinking in terms of, well, how much has this food been manipulated? Too much.
I don't think my food's been manipulated at all.
You're listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast that looks at research through a personal and critical lens. I'm your host, Chris Neff, and we're exploring the science of eating a healthy diet with my guest, Amanda Salas.
Can we talk about the paleo diet a little bit? Because, you know, there seems to be a lot of attention to it, and it does seem to be one of those fads that's come about, and you know, people are swearing by the paleo diet. What are your thoughts about the paleo diet?
So there's a lot of different interpretations of the paleo diet, and some research has shown that many people who follow a paleo diet are actually following really closely the public health recommendations for nutrition, which is a great thing. So they're actually eating small amounts of processed foods like treats, all that fun stuff, chocolate and things. They're eating a minimum amount of processed foods. They're eating large amounts of plant materials, so vegetables, in some instances fruit as well, a bit of meat, but also a whole variety of protein sources, some lentils, eggs. And this is really close to the public health recommendation, and that's a great thing. Other people follow paleo, interpret it in a slightly different way. They'll reduce carbohydrates to a to a great extent. So they'll have less than 40 grams of carbohydrate per day, whereas you or the average adult might eat around 150, 200 grams of carbohydrate today. So it's very restricted in carbohydrate. And this has been shown in medical research to significantly reduce appetite. So a lot of people swear by this very low carbohydrate paleo style of eating because they feel that, oh, thank goodness, at last my appetite is under control. When I eat carbs, I feel hungry, I just want to eat more. I hear a lot of people talk about a sense of relief and, oh, you know, it's so much easier to manage my weight, I don't feel hungry. But that's only one aspect of health. There's also your risk of disease later. And other research, and using a more broad framework, it's called a nutritional geometry framework that's being developed, led by leading nutrition researchers here at the University of Sydney. That's showing that, okay, well, low carbohydrate, high protein is beneficial for reducing fat, but it may not be as beneficial for other aspects. For example, control of blood glucose levels and potential development of diabetes.
And isn't carbohydrates, so one of these things feeds the brain? Like, isn't carbs brain food? Like, so, you know, I always say to my friends, you know, stop going to the gym and be more interesting. So worry less about taking pictures of your food and just be a more interesting person.
Carbohydrates are a brain food. They're also a gut food. So when you eat a low carbohydrate diet, in an extreme case, a very low carbohydrate diet that's high in animal protein, there's not much carbohydrate that gets into the gut and down deep into the intestine. And then the bugs that live in the intestine, they don't have much to eat. And so bad bugs can come in and take over. Whereas if you eat a diet that's got carbohydrates, it's got a lot of fiber particularly, then that feeds the good bacteria in the gut, and this has effects that influence the whole body for the good and also affect the brain as well. So carbohydrates not only feed the brain directly, but there's emerging research that the bugs in your intestine that eat the fiber from the carbohydrates that you eat also produce products that have an influence on your brain and the whole of your body.
Okay. Are we talking parasites or little bugs or what are we talking about?
Well, we're talking bacteria that live in your gut. There's around 10 times as many bacteria on your body and in your body as there are cells in your body. And these are very important
stuff. So we have to feed the bacteria. Well, my love of carbohydrates knows no bounds. Okay, well, one of the things I saw was that 9 years ago, you published a book titled The Don't Go Hungry Diet, which you say is about a lifestyle diet, not a calorie restriction diet.
I wrote this book based on the frustration of seeing many people around me who were always struggling with hunger when they lost weight. And as I was struggling with hunger when I was severely obese, but it never worked. Eventually, I would get hungry. And so I wrote this book to show people that if you listen to your body's hunger signal and eat accordingly, then you can actually manage your weight, because our bodies are designed to be at an optimum healthy weight. And when you gain excess weight, your hunger levels will actually be reduced. So what happens is if you listen to those signals very closely, and they're quite hard to hear because the signals are quite faint, especially when you've got windows that produce boxes of food that's very easy to attain. It's hard to hear those signals that tell you if you're not hungry or that you've had enough. But if you do tune into them and listen closely, then you'll be able to regulate your weight, because your body will do the regulating for you and following suit.
What is a hunger signal?
So you might feel it. Some people feel it in a grumbling at the stomach. Some people feel it in terms of just feeling a bit weak or lightheaded, a mood change. My husband feels my hunger in me. He says to me, "You're hungry, aren't you?" Which means I've probably snapped at him or something. So you can feel hunger in a whole lot of different ways. But any feeling that can be reliably prevented or reversed by food is hunger. So, the book is based on hunger and how you're listening to your hunger and eating mostly healthy foods according to hunger can actually lead to better weight management. And there's a whole lot of different ways of losing weight and keeping off. Like there's no one size fits all. And in our research at the university here, we're trying a whole range of different approaches to weight management because different approaches work for different people. What didn't work for me and what doesn't work for a lot of people is having to count foods. The instant I thought about that, I just wanted to binge eat on copious quantities of food. And that's where listening to hunger signals for me was incredibly liberating because instead of thinking, oh, no, I can't eat because I'm only allowed, 3,000 kilojoules or whatever per day, instead of thinking that, I just thought, yeah, I can eat what I want when I want. I just have to wait until I'm hungry before I eat it. And for me, that was like that was a life change. That changed my whole life. So we're using that strategy in clinical trials for people with binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa, and we're using that approach of listening to your hunger signals instead as a way to manage weight.
I love that. So can I ask, I remember when I was really short on money, and so I could afford two $1 double cheeseburgers from McDonald's, and that was it. And so one went in the fridge, and I had one for lunch and one for dinner. And I ballooned up. I definitely gained weight. And then last week, I remember there was the story about the oodles and noodles, so the college food that a lot of our students eat. It's got like 7 times as much sodium as, a normal meal. They end up with hardening of the arteries because they've had oodles and noodles every day but that's because that's what they can afford because it's, a dollar for five. Mm. So where does socioeconomic come into, nutrition? Because it can be expensive. What should people from lower socioeconomic, backgrounds or people who are advising them, what should we be telling people who don't have the money to?
Mm. I know that's a real, really important issue. And the fact is that nutritional diseases, so based on excess of some nutrients and deficiencies of other nutrients, are diseases that affect people of low socioeconomic status. So this is a really important issue and something that my research doesn't cover, but it's something that does need investigation and consideration. What's important to know is that, eating well, it does take time and it does take money, but there are some options for people to consider. Like, for example, less processed foods are not necessarily more expensive than more processed foods. And in fact, there's research to back that up and showing that, eating a healthier diet is not necessarily more expensive than eating an unhealthy diet, but it does take time to prepare and finding those sources of food in markets, etc. But lentils and beans are generally a very good source of protein and nutrition. And when I was a student in Geneva, at the end of every month my scholarship would dry up, so I would eat a lot of white bread and jam because that's what I could afford on the scholarship at the end of the month, but also a lot of lentils and, cheap veggie-based dishes, and, I got through the month.
A year ago, you published in The Conversation on the science of hangry, or why some people get grumpy when they're hungry. I understand it's one of the most read articles of all time on The Conversation, which everyone should subscribe to or follow on Twitter. Tell us a little bit more about the science and why you're more likely to have a short fuse when you're hungry.
So being angry and feeling snappy is one of the signs of hunger. And that's related to the fact that hunger is a stress response. So lack of food elicits a stress response. It's survival. But what lack of food does, and it can do this even between meals, is it elicits a stress response in your body. So, for example, you'll have cortisol, the stress hormone, pouring out of your adrenal glands when you're hungry, and this has effects to increase your blood glucose levels and help you feed the brain with glucose in the blood. This stress response from hunger will also increase the release of adrenaline from your adrenal glands. And this is the fight or flight hormone, you know, when you see something in the dark and think, oh my goodness, what is that? And that you can feel your body flooding with fright. That's adrenaline, which can make you behave in all sorts of ways. And at the same time, your brain is responding to hunger with changes in neurochemicals that regulate hunger. But what we've shown and other researchers have shown is that these same chemicals in the brain that respond to hunger and that drive us to forage and hunt for our food, these same chemicals are also regulating mood, anger, aggression. So they're very closely linked, and it makes sense when you think in terms of hunter-gathering and fighting for limited resources.
Exactly. And anybody who's got a partner who's ever done a long car ride knows that there's like a moment in the car ride where, okay, it's time to pull over.
Yes.
You need something, definitely. I think that your research is really fascinating, and I really appreciate you sharing it with us. Thank you for coming to Open for Discussion.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Open for Discussion, a University of Sydney podcast. If you have feedback about today's episode, email us at media.podcast@sydney.edu.au. Also, if you've enjoyed this episode, please review it on iTunes.